Hi guys, my name is Chris, and you are listening to the first episode of A Recovering Binge Watcher. This is a weekly podcast sort of looking at specific television shows and sort of looking into them in-depthly and reviewing them week by week, as opposed to a lot of television shows, which nowadays are sort of released all at once and you sort of watch it over a weekend and then kind of move on to the new thing. This episode, I was partnered up with a good friend of mine, Darnell. We talked about the first season of I May Destroy You, which had already gone and passed by the time we sort of came up with this podcast. And then we also talked about the first episode of the Netflix hit The Queen's Gambit. And then we also talk about The Mandalorian. The Mandalorian is a recurring show that we're going to be sort of discussing. But at the time of this recording, we had only gotten to episode 4. Episode 5, which just came out the day after Thanksgiving, was a pretty huge episode in terms of mythology and the expanded Star Wars universe. So that is not discussed. We do talk about the what that episode was going to be, but I am actually going to record an episode tomorrow to discuss that episode. So if you're listening to it now and you're wondering why we're not talking about the big episode, that's going to be coming soon. So I'm going to be greeted here with my friend Darnell, and I will see you guys later. So I have with me my very good friend of 16 years.
Only very good.
Like decent, like okay, like okay, whatever. Okay. You could maybe call him if you need a ride.
Yeah, probably.
My good friend Darnell, we've known each other, like I said, for about like 15, 16 years, which makes me feel really, really old. But in the best way, you're the person for this podcast because we actually met at University of the Arts and we became friends because we were in a computer lab and we were both watching Lost at the same time.
Facts. I forgot about that. That was it. Fucking Jack Shepherd brought us together.
so we started having Lost nights. We became friends. We graduated 4 years of writing college together. And then I moved out to California. You moved out a couple years later. Literally just got off the conversation of you wanting to leave.
They don't need to know that.
My friend once told me the I think it was from a tweet, someone said that the dream of LA is to get out to LA, and then the dream of LA is to be successful enough to move out of LA.
That's so true. It's like, I can't wait till I get enough so I can pack my fucking bags. So true. So
I know the show is called a Recovering Binge Watcher, but there are a bunch of television shows that we watched over the course of 2020 that I really wanted to talk about. I was going to do like, what was the best stuff that you watched so far? But every time I went down the list, I was like, I'd rather just have a conversation about the show than it be 5 minutes. So I want to start out with I May Destroy You, because this is a show you did not shut the fuck up about.
You're right. I blew you and Kim's like text messaging up with my like Iliad level of text messages about it like every week. Yeah.
It was funny because we would be talking about like, I don't know, like something to do with like the election or whatever. Yeah. And you'd be like, this reminds me of this episode. And then I finally started watching it. I really wanted to text you. How the fuck did this remind you?
I don't know. You know me. I have a random ass brain. You know me. So, yeah.
So I May Destroy You, I had a really weird experience with the show because before it came out, I mean, I had actually seen Chewing Gum. So
okay.
I knew what, you know, the capabilities, but people told me that it was a comedy. Like it was a comedy. And I watched the first episode. And I want to sort of relate this to, you sent me a text a while ago about The Undoing, which I have not seen yet.
Right.
But you said the first episode of The Undoing is sort of like an introduction to the character of Nicole Kidman, but then it sort of ends with like, okay, I guess this is what the show is about, but I just spent 45, 50 minutes with nothing really else happening.
Mm-hmm.
that's actually kind of how I felt about I May Destroy You's first episode, mm-hmm. where I was like, okay, so this is a show about a woman who seems to be unlucky in love, because it starts out with her and the guy overseas.
Yeah.
It's very clear to the viewer that, like, she is way more into this.
Yes.
Yes. And then she kind of goes home to London, and she needs to write a book, and it's clear that she's bullshitting, as we did through 4 years of college.
Yeah.
That she has no idea what this book is, and she has a deadline, and then she keeps procrastinating and things get in the way, and she goes out one night for drinks. And I was like, okay, we're like almost at the end. And yeah. What is this show about? And then it hits you with the fact that she was raped the night that she went out. And I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, I'm not entirely sure why we needed 30 minutes of getting to that point. But so I was told it was a comedy. I watched it. I was like, it's kind of funny. Like, it's mm-hmm. it's amusing. The second episode was not. It was super serious.
Yes.
And I was just like, okay, like, A, I'm actually glad this topic is being told seriously, because when I heard it was a comedy and then I found out what it was about, I was like, this is going to be tricky. And I hope this isn't the show that asked the question, can we laugh about rape? Because that's very iffy. And then the third episode was an unprecedented flashback.
Right,
another time. And I'm like, this is three episodes in. So I will tell you, it actually kind of took me about 4 or 5 episodes to finally like get with the groove of the show.
Yeah.
Which I know I'm in the minority. A lot of people were like,
You're actually not. I got thrown into, I'm sorry, I was being rude. You're the host. I just interrupted you.
No, right, no, go ahead.
But it's what we do. We've been doing this for 16 years. I'm actually in I May Destroy You like Facebook group, and you're not in a minority. A lot of people felt the same exact way that you feel.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you, like I said, you talked nonstop about this show. I do want to say I ended up really enjoying the show once I got through those first couple of episodes. And then I definitely want to talk about the finale, which was very interesting. But what was it about I May Destroy You that like just hooked you in so much?
So it's really interesting, especially, you know, when we put it up against the text that I sent you about The Undoing. It's weird. Like, I think because we've seen so much TV, I think our brain sometimes is oriented to expect things to play out a certain way. And I think that's what I was texting you about The Undoing. Like this doesn't feel like TV is the way I'm supposed to see it. Like, I don't want an entire episode of Pre-Existing Life, you know, which is what I think The Undoing was. But it's weird, when I watched I May Destroy You, I think the rape was a plot moment, but I don't really think the show is really about the rape. I think the show is about this woman who is talented and is a hot mess, but is trying to figure out her life, and that rape is the catalyst for her to figure out her life. But it's really about all of this shit that's going on, because there's that whole episode with her and the whole like no meat thing, and that has nothing to do with the rape really, but it's also about her trying to figure herself out. So that's not even remotely what you asked. Like, what did it why was I so enamored with it? A bunch of things. Like, I'd never seen those type of characters on screen before. They're just all a mess. They're all really, really great friends, but they all have really, really complicated issues. And that really kind of struck me. They had a weird sense of comedy and like humor that I think you, me and Kim and Bree and Jason all kind of have. Like, I felt like we were watching people joke about things that were like inappropriate, but it's like out in the world. So like that kind of drew me in. I loved seeing Black British characters that like I know nothing about their culture, and yet it still felt so super familiar. That really drew me in. The episode with Kwame, you know, not just to him getting raped, but the way that he was treated in the police station, I think was some of the best television I've ever seen in my entire life, because I think as an American, I have been, geared to associate sex through the Law and Order SVU lens, which is typically the woman is the victim. And I've never had the same emotional response that I have seeing it happen to like a woman on SVU than to a man. And my heart broke for Kwame. And that's what, I mean, I think that's when I really like locked into the show. Like they are doing something different. And I like that it just felt poetic a lot, you know, especially the finale. The finale just is, and we'll get into that later, but like it just, it didn't feel like your typical show. It felt like she literally is just putting her heart on these pages. And yeah, it's a lot there for sure.
Yeah, I kind of got the sense that the show wasn't specifically just about rape, but it was about consent. And consent in all the different variations, whether it be sexual or friendship, or even when she kind of goes overboard with her social media and it sort of backfires on her.
Yeah.
And I also thought very much as you sort of get the sense in the last two episodes, it feels like she was figuring out what the show was actually about as the character is figuring out what her story is actually about. And sort of putting those together. I mean, like in terms of her character, obviously she knew what the show was, but it sort of just gives you these different ideas of consent when she, you know, when she throws in Kwame at the party and she throws him into the room with the other guy. And, you know, the next episode, they have this really long kind of blowout about it. And the two of them are arguing that the other one doesn't really understand what they're going through.
Right.
And how she sort of saw herself as bigger than her two friends who were trying to help her. And I really liked that this show, I think, did an honest depiction of what a friendship like that would be. Instead of this turning into they fight, they break up, they don't see each other, and then something brings them back together at the end. It was definitely a show that was like, okay, well, we honestly talk about it, and 5 minutes later, we've been best friends since forever. So we kind of figure out and move on. But
and the fact that friends do shitty things to each other, and like you have to, and sometimes you swallow that, because ultimately there's the moment when Arabella learns that, I forget the best friend's name, the other gorgeous woman there, and it's super smart and everything. Yeah, like she finds out that she left her there. You know what I mean? Like you were my best friend, like you were supposed to look out for me and you didn't. And I'm not saying that she was the cause of the rape, but like she had a big part to play in the events after that, and Arabella putting things together. And like Arabella has like swallowed, like she accepted, you know, her apology, and like they were still friends after that. And I loved seeing that, like, as friends, you're going to blow up and you're going to do dumb shit to your friends, but it's still another day, you know, you still make it work. And like exactly how you said, like, it isn't the way it is on TV shows where like I do something shitty to Chris, then we argue about it, then somebody else tells me, no, you've known him for 16 years, and then we have some kumbaya moment and like the end. That's not the way real life really is, you know?
And I also thought it was really interesting as the show went on and we sort of got into Arabella's past with her life at school and the woman that she would eventually meet in a support group again, and sort of saw things from her point of view. And the whole episode with her father and figuring out like what the issues were there. And I think that's another really great example where instead of airing out everything that they have for each other, it is sort of more like, this is just kind of the way it goes. And there's no big reconciliation at the end. It's sort of like, this is just how our life is now. And nothing, like Arabella is not going to make a grand speech that's going to fix her family at the end. So I thought that was really interesting. Getting into the last two episodes, because the second to last episode sort of ends with her realizing that she spotted the man who raped her. She constantly keeps going back to the scene of crime. And then we sort of segue into the finale where it felt like, have you ever seen the movie version of Clue?
Yes, long time ago. Long time ago. Yeah.
So, you know, if you were like me, you probably saw it like on cable or VHS. Mm-hmm. You didn't see it in the theater. Because what they did in the movie theater was that they sent out three different endings to multiple movie theaters. So depending on the movie theater you saw a different ending. It was kind of like, remember when we were in college and they came out with X-Men Origins?
Yeah.
Every it depended on what theater you went to, the after credit scene was different.
Interesting. Yeah.
That you got. But I saw Clue on VHS and cable, and they combined the three endings together. So the last like 10 minutes of Clue is like, this is what happened. No, wait, actually, this is what happened. For real, this is what happened. And I kind of got that deja vu when I was watching I May Destroy You, because she shows like three possible different endings to what Arabella does. One of them is this like extreme, she completely gets revenge on him and every other rapist in the world. Mm-hmm. Another is a weird, he turns into like the Joker and starts and actually turns it around on her. And then another one is sort of like she doesn't actually do anything. She doesn't confront him and leaves it pretty much up to the audience to sort of figure out, you know, what is the real ending and does that ending even truly honestly matter in a very lost way? Is the journey more important than the ending of it all? And I kind of got a sense that even before we saw the finale, something was happening, even though the finale didn't actually address this specific issue. But I would say the one thing is when she meets up back with the writer who she exposed as a rapist.
Zane, that was his name, yeah.
And they did this thing where like they come together to like put her story like together on the thing. And I was like, this seems like bullshit. this doesn't seem like it actually happened, because this is a... While the show was doing a very good job of realistically doing these relationships, I'm not entirely sure that I buy that that would ever happen, that they would see each other again and they would talk it out and then they would do that. I mean, obviously with friends, it's one thing. With a person you sort of met, like it's and then outed them, it's very different. And then that led to in the show where it had three completely different endings. Do you subscribe to a specific ending, or do you think like it didn't really matter what the ending of I May Destroy You was?
So it's interesting. I don't really look at them as endings first, because I think what they were, as opposed to endings, they were her three complicated emotions that she actually went through, because I May Destroy You is based on, you know, what actually happened to her. I think it's what she felt. I think, you know, in those moments, there are moments where she wanted to get revenge on this dude because, you know, he did that to her. And I also think that there's this weird complicated version of it where, you know, and this is the difficult part of it. Like, sometimes you may go out to a club and you want to fuck some dude and you want it to be aggressive and you want it to be dirty and you want it to be all of those things, and that should be okay too. Like, I think that's a complicated issue. And then there's the other thing where like you want to forgive this man, and I think as opposed to her giving us giving us endings, I think she was giving us a peek into what all of the emotions were that she's going through, because I think very much like the Sopranos thing, it's like, it doesn't matter what they do, everybody's gonna hate it, right? Whether you kill Tony or you leave him alive or you let the screen play out or you cut it to black, you're not gonna give everybody what they want. And I think instead of saying, let me give this a finite ending, let me give the viewers a peek into what I was feeling. Because you and me are two guys, we can't ever know what it feels like to go through that. But I have to imagine that it's not just some simple, I just wanted to kill the dude. It's not a simple, like, I wanted to, because the second one was really about her taking, or maybe it was a third one. There was one about taking power back, right? It was like she wanted it because like she actually F's him in the bed and stuff like that. And then he says, hey, can I stay? And she says, no. And then, you know, so that one was really about power. And to your question, it's not that I don't subscribe to either one. I subscribe to all of them because I think all of them are the ending, that she feels all of those things. And there isn't really an ending, right? Because it's not like she wakes up and it's like, it's done and everything's good. I think she will constantly deal with those issues. And we have to constantly deal with the fact that she's conflicted with all of those.
Yeah, I would agree with you, because I think at the end, at the actual ending is when she has completed her book and
right.
is about to read into it, but we don't get the idea of what is actually in the book. I think this show was essentially about her figuring out her emotions of like, what did she really feel and how did she want to act upon it? And then maybe the realization that there isn't really a way to act upon it, because even if she, it's pretty much told halfway into the show that there is no way to bring this man to justice, because the case has essentially been dropped.
The legal way. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah, illegal way. Yeah.
I mean, she could straight up kill him and then say, right. that's justice.
Well, it's the ego death. It's what she did to Zane. Like, you can get justice with cops, or you can take justice in your own hands and destroy him the other way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was really happy with the ending, because I was curious, how were they going to wrap this up? Because as the show went on, it became about more than just what happened to her. It became mm-hmm. about like what has happened to other people and how she has to reevaluate her own actions, because now she sees, oh, well, I thought this was nothing, but now I realize that it actually is something. I throw in my best friend into a room with another guy that he's uncomfortable with. I now understand like right. where this is coming from. So I was glad. Question, do you think that she will follow this up, or do you think this is a one and done show?
I think after, and I did a deep dive into her watching all interviews, I think this is a one and done. She seems like a very like passion driven writer. Like, she became a Christian for a certain point, and then that's when chewing gum came about, you know? So she feels very, and I hope so, because I think that the poetry of that ending, I don't need more, you know? I want to be left with this emotion, with this show, and you don't need to add on to it at all.
I have this very, I have very strong belief that Phoebe Waller-Bridge will return to Fleabag at some point. not now or in the future. Like, I think in like 5 to 10 years, she's going to have a new story. And because so much of that show is her, that she's going to return to it and she's going to want to tell it in a personal way.
Right.
I wonder if I May Destroy You will be that for her, where she feels like, oh, I've come to this new thing. Why don't I bring the show back with these characters and sort of show them as, you know, more grown adults later on in life? Mm-hmm. But I think that this is essentially all it is for now. I think what will happen is that, you know, BBC and HBO will want more from her.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Get her.
If it doesn't win all of the awards, like, if they haven't mailed them to her already, it's a fucking travesty. I mean, this show is chef's kiss, as you would say. It's perfect. Yeah.
I did have a friend who told me, like, inevitably, she's going to be writing for Marvel. That's just what
happened. I mean, like, why not? Why not? I mean, she does a really good job of making, I can say, like, I appreciated seeing dark skin black people on screen, and yet it was so relatable to everyone. You know what I mean? Like, I'm talking to you, I've talked to my friend Brooks, so many people. And I think that's the mark of a great writer, right? Like, I felt intrinsically linked to her because of her culture and everything. And it felt so steeped, especially the parents episode, where like, you're getting the whole food thing. And like, the thing that you were saying in terms of like her with the parents, like, this is just what life is now. That's a lot with a lot of families, right? It's like, there is no big like catharsis moment. It's like, well, this is just the way it is. Like, and we just swallow it and we suck it up. And that felt so relatable. I love that. So yeah, she should totally write for every fucking person, everybody in the world, yeah.
So to go from a show about black characters and black culture mm-hmm. to a show with, I think, one black character in it.
Jolene, yeah, one.
I want to talk about The Queen's Gambit, which is another show that you told me about like 7 times, but
only 7? Yeah.
you and a lot of other people, and I think someone had mentioned to me that there was an NFL game like last weekend or something where one of the announcers was like, yeah, so I'm watching the Queen's Gambit. And they were like,
wait, was it Joe Buck? It sounded like something Joe Buck would say.
No, because I remember the good old days of Joe Buck and Troy Aikman where they just talked about 24 for like...
Yeah, literally.
You know, that Jack Bauer, I mean...
Yeah, such great cell service. Like,
and there's Don McNabb getting a pass done. You know, just like Jack Bauer got the number of the terrorists on this Sunday on Fox. The Queen's Gambit... is a really interesting story because it's about a little white girl who goes to an orphanage and just becomes a master at chess through drugs, and it's totally captured the Corona Nation. It's number one on Netflix for a really long time, but it's one of these Netflix shows which has clearly sort of surpassed just the streaming service or just this is the new Netflix show. It does feature my favorite up-and-coming star, Anya Taylor-Joy, who I first saw in The Witch. After watching her in The Witch, I was just like, she needs to be the next big thing.
Yeah.
And it took a little longer than I kind of expected. Maybe it's because she did New Mutants and that movie was delayed
years. How long ago was The Witch? How long ago was that?
The Witch... it was probably like 2014 or something.
Oh, okay. It's not that bad. Yeah.
But yeah, so I 2015. I was off by a year.
Okay. Okay.
So it sort of took a little bit for her, and now she's gotten this role. She was recently in what my friend has named the 17th remake of Emma. But the big news was that she was cast in George Miller's Furiosa prequel / spinoff. It was really awesome. I just knowing how long it took to get Fury Road.
Yeah.
When they filmed it. Like they filmed Fury Road in like 2012 and it came out summer 2015. And I was oh shit.
I mean, we can't say Fury Road without saying like almost best action movie of all time. Yes. Almost, yeah. Like so, such a good movie. Yeah.
So I'm really excited for her. So actually, she was like the really big draw in me watching the show because I was like, I really want to see what they've done with her. And as the rule of this podcast, I've only watched one episode out of the seven. It definitely felt like when I was watching it, I'm like, I feel like I'm seeing 40 to 50 minutes of what would happen if this was a movie. Mm-hmm. But then they tell the director, okay, you need to take the 40 minutes and cut it down to 10. And
yeah.
Put it in there because the first episode is really how this girl ended up in an orphanage and how she sort of went through that day to day. It kind of falls into, I think, a lot of the tropes and cliches of every kid that goes into an orphanage story where she's sort of taken advantage of, she doesn't have any friends, no one really wants, she's not gonna get adopted, she's not gonna get all these things. And then it turns, and then I wanna know if you had the same reaction I did when she starts playing chess with the custodial.
Mm-hmm.
This fucker wouldn't just teach her how to play chess.
No.
She's like, well, how do I do that? No, I won. It's over. Go back to bed.
That's it. In the most deadpan monotone voice known to man.
I was like, he's such a dick. And he didn't even like start getting better until he realized that she was beating him constantly. And then was just like, oh, well, you need to figure out the pawn 7c method and, and you know, knowing the letters to the board and all those things. And then eventually he brings in that chess teacher. But I was like, I hope I'm not supposed to feel like good about this custodial guy because he's every older generation that doesn't want to teach the newer generation stereotype of a character. That I was like, he's just a dick. But what I thought was really interesting about this episode and the question I had going into it, which is that how are they going to make chess interesting for people who don't give a shit about chess? Mm-hmm. I was totally a chess player in grade school and high school. And so I love chess, but I was, if you try to talk about chess with anyone for like more than 5 minutes, it's, they just drone out.
And right.
I think what they did really well was that they tied chess into her own sort of character arc, and how she, her losing to this guy was almost in parallel to her constantly being at this orphanage. And
that's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to say it's, I think they cracked it in that it's not about chess. Chess is the window into her, and they just made her a completely, you can't take your eyes off of her character, whether she's little girl in the orphanage or grown woman. That was the key, because it's really not about chess, you know, and that's what makes it so interesting. Chess just gives you a peek into why she is the way she is, why she has to do the things that she ends up doing, and everything else that happens later in the show without spoiling it. But yeah.
Halfway into the episode, the most Philly thing anyone can say, it's like Rocky. Like,
yeah.
Which we kind of use for every movie, but
everything.
But I was like, this is like Rocky, where it wasn't about him really fighting at all. Mm-hmm. It was, it mm-hmm. used the fight to get into him. And then the fight is, the good Rocky movies are when the fight's a metaphor for something.
Right.
It's not right. just about a fight, unless you get to Rocky IV and it's just them landing 97% of their punches.
Yes.
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really interesting, the sort of drug angle they took, and her sort of becoming addicted to these tranquilizers. I couldn't help, last year I was hit by a car and was in the hospital for a really long time, and man, when they take you off the morphine, it's hard. Difficult. And I like totally was with her in that moment. And when she went to go steal the giant jug of tranquilizers,
It look like candy too. They like color corrected it to make them look all like super nice looking blue, like it was Skittles and shit.
I was gonna say, it reminded me in Breaking Bad when they changed the color. But I really enjoyed the first episode. I'm very interested in where it goes. The show opens with a really sort of interesting sort of like one shot as we like go down the hallway, and then we just cut and we never see Anya again and until I assume later on in the season of seven episodes. Also was really intrigued to find out that Heath Ledger was going to direct this.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's interesting the way you brought it up about the whole, like, the first episode feels like how you said, like, the first 10 minutes, because it's been in production or been in development as a feature for so long that, like, man, like, you can feel that. But, like, I'm so glad that they expanded it to the show, because it gave you so much more to work with, it looks like. Even in the pilot, you could see that, you know.
Yeah. So I'm super excited to talk about where it goes into episode 2 next week. But the Queen's Gambit, so far, I've gotten 5 minutes of Anya Taylor-Joy and I'm already in. I really like the actress that they got for her herself. Because she, without having a whole lot of dialogue, is able to convey every emotion that this character is feeling.
Yes.
And really cool. Lastly, I wanted to talk about The Mandalorian. My midnight obsession.
I figured you stay up till midnight to watch it. Like, I've always been wondering, like, does he just sit and just like wait for it to turn 12:01 and he cuts that shit on?
Well, you have to wait till 12:05 because Disney Plus can never put it on at the
same. Oh, okay. Good to know.
I watched it midnight when it first came on last year, and then it hasn't stopped. I've gone everyone. I think there's like one or two episodes where I was like, I don't really think a whole lot's gonna happen. Can I just like skip? No? Okay, we'll go back to that tomorrow. Go back to sleep. I love The Mandalorian. I'm a little surprised. I still remain a little surprised it's become the huge, massive hit that it is, because it's such a niche story. Like, it, yeah. Like story-wise, we could recap the story in like three sentences. Like, nothing really dramatic here happens. And I was curious as we were getting into season two, I was like, last year, I think it had the benefit that a lot of fans were out on Star Wars, whether it be The Last Jedi or what it was going to be with The Rise of Skywalker, and they just weren't into it. And then here comes Jon Favreau with this Western motif show, and everyone just went to it because they were like, this is what we want in Star Wars.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm totally with you, but I feel like if this were a movie, y'all wouldn't be as into this as it is.
No, I agree with you. Yeah.
Television show. And so I was curious because I didn't think, my personal belief, I think this is the show and Favreau's not going to budge from this being the show for the most part. I think we are going to get sort of special episodes like we did last year where it's like, oh, well, this is Moff Gideon and here he is with the TIE fighter and he's coming to fight and we're going to have this group up of all the heroes and do all that. But I think for the most part, it's Mandalorian.
Star Wars together. Yeah.
He walks into a town, he does a job, he leaves. That's the Western motif and that's what it is. And then it just happens to be, they've created this really cute phenomenon that is Baby Yoda.
Yes.
Season two, I was really excited. I love the Timothy Olyphant episode.
Yes.
I think it's possibly the best Western-y of the episodes. And not just because they got the guy who plays in Marshall and Deputy.
Yeah.
Every single Western, but it was also directed by Favreau, and you can tell that this was just like, this is what he loves. He loves his Western idea. And then we got to like the second episode, which was the passenger one with the giant spiders, which was sort of just your standard episode of the week, fun, but nothing really substantial comes. And then we get to episode three, where we're introduced to the character of Bo-Katan, played by Katie Sackhoff.
I mean, you skipped the whole like last 30 seconds of the end of episode one. Fucking Fett is still alive, possibly. Like, you skipped all of that.
Well, the reason I skipped it, because you know they're not coming back to this for.
Yeah, I know.
I had a friend text me that they were upset that they were like, I thought their Boba Fett was going to be in episode two. And I was like, two?
No. Season four, maybe, if you're lucky.
I was like, he came in, they shaved off his eyebrows, he walked to the camera, and then he went home.
That's it.
No, I do think Fett is probably going to come back probably in like six or seven or something, and they'll sort of resolve the storyline. But three is when they sort of introduced Bo-Katan, and this was the thing that I was so curious about for 2 years, is knowing that Favreau's second in command is Dave Filoni, who did the Clone Wars and Rebels for so many years and is a huge fan favorite to sort of take over Star Wars. When were they going to start introducing the characters that he made in those animated shows? Some of them have really incredible relevance, like Bo-Katan did, where she reveals that, you know, hey, this idea that you don't take off your mask, that's weird. Like, that's not what we do. You're part of some weird religious cult thing. And also sort of the fact that she comes from Mandalore and what has happened to the planet of Mandalore through the time of the original trilogy and all that. And then there's others that are sort of like, I'm not entirely sure how they're going to fit in. I don't think it's too much of a secret anymore that since she name dropped Ahsoka Tano, who is a huge fan favorite cartoon character, who's rumored to be played by Rosario Dawson, and that she's going to come in. And I'm really interested to see how they relate these two things. How does the former apprentice of Darth Vader fit into Mando trying to find Yoda's home, you know?
Right.
Those are really interesting. I wanted to get your take because you have no idea who Bo-Katan is.
No.
And
no.
And up until she probably took her helmet off, you didn't know that Katie Sackhoff.
No, I literally said Ofrak when she took it off. So I was like, yeah.
That she was going to be in it. Katie Sackhoff's one of the rare cases where they got an already established actor to voice this character in the cartoon show. So, mm-hmm.
So she was the voice in the cartoon as well. Oh, see, I didn't know that either. Okay.
So this is sort of Jon Favreau was a voice in that show as well.
Interesting.
He was. I don't want to say too much. We'll talk about it like as we get to the end of the season, in case they bring this up. But Favreau and Filoni met in 2007, 2008, because Favreau was doing the sound mixing to Iron Man at the Lucasfilm places, right as Dave Filoni was putting together the first season, the first couple episodes, which George Lucas then decided to release as a theatrical movie. And Favreau came in, they got along, and he's just like, hey, if you ever need me for anything, hit me up. And then Dave Filoni did, he cast them as a Mandalorian, who is quite important with what seems to be like the underlying Mandalorian story of the show is. Mm-hmm. And it's just really funny to know Favreau was just voicing this character in 2008. All of a sudden, a couple of years later, him and Filoni are basically running the only Star Wars content we're getting
for
a while. And it is about this Mandalore culture that they made. So it's really interesting, but as they went on later in the show, they sort of were able to get more sort of Hollywood actors to come in. They got Katie Sackhoff, and then that's what I think everyone is sort of enamored with, is the fact that Bryce Dallas Howard has the difficult job of translating that animated character into live action, making it so that all the fans of this character are like, oh my God, that's Bo-Katan, that's great. And then for everyone else, who the fuck is this?
right. And she was still a dope character. I don't know what my emotional reaction would have been seeing her in the cartoon, but yeah. I thought she was a dope, I like every episode so far of the show, and I thought she was a dope character. Yeah.
And Katie Sackhoff, like I said, voiced the character, so she got to play her in live action, whereas what they're going to be doing with Ahsoka, where she was not voiced, spoiler alert, she wasn't voiced by Rosario Dawson for 10 seasons. But they've cast Rosario. She's been a fan favorite to play the character for a really long time. They still haven't like officially announced that this is happening, but it's happening.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited to see what she looks like. I'm a little afraid because, Ahsoka is an alien. She's not a normal human. And so I'm afraid of what she is going to look like. This show thankfully seems to have embraced the puppet prosthetic culture.
They have. It looks great on screen. Like it really, really looks good so far. Yeah. And
I'm happy that they've, for a lot of reasons. I mean, 90% of the show is CG, but the
character, especially all the exterior stuff. You know what I mean? Like that shit's incredible. Like,
yeah. So the other thing is, so understanding that this is a character, did you sort of get the sense that Bo-Katan was like an already established character, or when you met her, you had no idea, and then you went online and found out a bunch of people were talking about her?
So I didn't go online at all. I just like went to you, like I texted you, like after, you know, I did the thing that I normally do. I figured that she had to be somebody important because it was Katie. You know what I mean? Like I didn't get the sense that Timothy's character was going to be somebody that I was going to see again. But the fact that she had Mandalore armor on and it was Katie, I was like, oh, she must be somebody important. So I still haven't gone on to see anything about her character from the TV show. I've never seen one single episode from any of those cartoons, but now I feel like I need to.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing I was going to say, is that I was curious if they were going to introduce the character and basically kind of push an audience to, hey, you should go watch these episodes from like 2010 or whatever. But what I thought was really interesting is that Bo-Katan's character does have a complicated backstory and who she's related to and what she does and how she ends up in this role and all those things. But essentially, they told you everything you really needed to know about
the exactly game. That's what I was going to say. If her intro was weaker, I would have felt like what you just said, like you guys are trying to push me to go get the rest of her story by watching the cartoon. Her intro was strong enough. I'm like, oh, she's a dope ass character. I'm probably going to see her again. But if I don't, I know enough to be like, oh, that was great. Like, you know.
And to a lesser extent, Timothy Oliphant's character is actually a character from the recent books.
Interesting.
And they've sort of altered his backstory a little bit. I did get a kick out of his flashback sequence, which is someone was like, this is shot for shot Iron Man.
Like, oh wow. Yeah.
He comes, they even have the shot where he like shoots the missile and waits and it
yeah tank, and then
the scene in Iron Man where he just shoots and he's walking away as it blows.
That's up. Right, actually. That's a good point.
And I was like, either Favreau's doing this on purpose or it just comes naturally to him.
Yeah.
I get the sense that Oliphant will be back in. I think they're going to do exactly what they did last year, where there's going to be some big thing and he's going to call upon his friends to hit him up. And then there's also, I have this nagging thing where I'm like, they're going to spin a bunch of shit out of this show. Whether it's going to be like Katie and the Mandalorians, or it's going to be like Timothy Oliphant's Western adventures in Star Wars, or they make some kind of like Suicide Squad team. I think Disney is smart enough to know that they should start taking these characters that they set up and give them their own shows.
Yeah. I think the smart thing that they've done so far, which is really interesting that you're saying, you know, when you look at Last Jedi and Rise and all of that, I think what, for me, what's been interesting about watching Mando is the simplistic nature of it. Like, it seems like everything is just pulled. That's what I love about it. It's like, I watched that Bo-Katan thing and I still enjoyed it just as like a casual fan that knows nothing about it. It's just simplistic. And I think that's what's been interesting in that there's been so much layered on the Star Wars universe with the movies and stuff. And it feels like a big fucking hoagie right now. But Mando is just like you said, like you just watch one episode, he comes into town, boom, you get it, and it works. And it's just simple, you know?
Yeah, I wonder if it is going to get a little more complicated as we go along, because there are certain things from season one where they sort of hinted at what the larger Empire story is. Mm-hmm. And in the last episode, we sort of got even more hints that this might connect with the sequel trilogy. In more ways than it already does, which makes sense, because I think one of the things that Favreau did really well is I think he picked up on a lot of things that I think JJ wanted to use in his movie. The idea that the great thing that JJ did when he brought back the Empire, besides the fact that it seems like it's just lazy, all he did was like redesign it and bring him back. Mm. I think JJ's intention was to talk about how you can't just kill evil right. stays. And I mean, we saw this in America with a shocking return to Nazis.
Yeah.
Like that symbol doesn't go away. You don't destroy the Death Star and then it's over. Mm-hmm. And Favreau, I think, has done a really good job of showing how like desperate these Empire people are to like stay on. And they are definitely doing something with Baby Yoda, and why do they need Baby Yoda, and how does that work into I'm happy they're doing it, because I think it is the duty of all Star Wars spinoffs to just make sense of the movies more.
Yeah.
That's definitely what Dave Filoni did with his cartoon shows, which was to like take the prequels and, you know, let's make them good. And so I think that's exactly what they're going to do with the sequel trilogy. But yeah, I think I'm really happy that this show has been very simple.
Yeah.
And I think I've known a lot of people who like, this is their gateway to Star Wars, that they just turned.
That's interesting.
And they were able to go with it. Because if you think about it, even though it is a little bit questionable why Mando seems to know fucking nothing about anything, like he doesn't really know about the Mandalorians, which makes sense given that he was taken by a specific group and then he was told this is everything, and then he realizes, oh wait, that's not. But he also has said like he has no idea who the Jedi are. Like he doesn't know. And I think that is specifically because if you are new to Star Wars, you are seeing the show through his eyes.
Right.
And you don't really know who he is. And I think they were smart that they knew that they were going to draw in people with Baby Yoda and it being on Disney Plus to get people who've never seen Star Wars to watch their show. And then if you've only seen the original trilogy or if you've only seen the first Star Wars movie, you still get it. Like there's nothing in here that's like too complicated. We haven't gotten into, I mean, I'm sure they are, but we haven't gotten into like the midichlorians and we haven't gotten into clones and they definitely are going to go into that, but we just haven't really, I think if they're going to touch upon it the same way they've done with Bo-Katan, then it's going to be great because I think they are saying like, what is the bare bones that you need? And at the same time, it's still about Mando and this baby and they're going to have an adventure every week and then go on. The only thing I hope is that this show doesn't outstay its welcome. I do hope that they don't go on for like 6 years doing Mando's story. I would really hope that this goes on for maybe like 3 or 4 years and then calls it quits and then just have John
Favreau. When you say 3 or 4 years, you mean like legit one more season or?
I would like 2 more seasons of this show. Just because I think there's a couple of things. They eventually do have to pull in a legitimate, this is the story of the Mandalorian. Because I don't think fans are going to want 4 years in to still have it just be he goes into a town, he does a mission, and that's it. It's over.
I agree. I do think it has to get a little bit more complex in that way. But again, I don't know what they're doing. But what's interesting is having a Baby Yoda, have a guy like Mando as the person watching that. And to me, what's interesting, and it may not even go in this direction, but like the idea of he's in, you know, taking from Twilight, like he's imprinting on this kid. And like, what does it look like if this kid's now a fucking teenager? You know, like you're raising somebody that like has all of this power and, you know, he's got all this shit from you. So I feel like there is a lot of story, but you have to get more into the minutia and the complexity of character of who he is beneath that armor a little bit more. And I think that could make it last a little bit longer. If you just do, like you're saying, the Shane of it all, that will wear kind of thin really, really quickly.
Yeah. And I think we start to see a little bit of the fact that Mando's not really a parent to this kid. As we got the controversy with Baby Yoda committing genocide. Poor woman's frogs.
It was so horrible. The way they were playing it, like it was comedy. And I'm like, no, he's like killing people. He's like eating these species right now. That's not cool. Peyton Reed, I think he directed that episode. It's not cool.
The most tense I've been was when he's with them in episode 3. And I'm just like, don't get him too close.
Yes.
But yeah, I'm excited. Episode 5 is going to be, next weekend we'll talk about it, is apparently the big episode where a lot of people think they're going to introduce Ahsoka.
Interesting.
This will be another, they're introducing a character from the expanded universe. How does the audience take it? I have a feeling they're not going to go into Ahsoka's backstory and be like, oh yeah, so like I was trained by Anakin Skywalker. Have you ever heard of him? Or all the
zoom in on the helmet. Dun, 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 dun.
Or all the things that she's experienced.
Yeah.
I have a feeling they're going to do exactly what they did with Bo-Katan, where it's just like,
I agree.
This is who she is. This is why she's relevant to Mando. And this is where we're going to go with the story.
It's the argument that I always make with the Harry Potter stuff, right? I don't know if it was Kim that said this or like, I know I was around somebody and they like made this reference like, oh, they didn't put like the Quidditch match from like page 473. And I'm like, well, because they don't need to, because they knew you were going to already go watch it. They're not making the movie for you. They're making it for average fucking viewers like me. So it's like, I think the way they introduced Katie's character worked for somebody, like, because they knew yo ass was going to watch it. And if they, like you said, if they do it the same exact way, like, you know, that's how you get people like fucking, you know, everybody in the world watching this show. Cause I don't feel like I need to go back to A New Hope. I don't have to watch any of these other things. It works on its own. Even if it had nothing to do with Star Wars, it's, and I think that's what Favreau was, the brilliant thing that he did. He started with a great base. It's just a good show that dot, dot, dot just happens to be also in the Star Wars world. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, cool. Darnell, thank you so much for joining me.
All right, guys, thank you so much to listening to the first episode of A Recovering Binge Watcher. Thank you, Darnell, for joining me. As I mentioned in the intro, the next episode is going to be going into episode 5 of The Mandalorian, which, again, was a really, really big episode. I'll have a lot of things to talk about, and hope to see you guys then.